I mean, when Indonesia achieved its independence from the Dutch, it was after really quite a violent, hard struggle against the Dutch following World War II. They fought hard for that, it meant a great deal to them. They were a very diverse colony, the Dutch East Indies, and I think for the Dutch nationalists it was quite important to forge what was really, in many ways you could argue, an artificial nation, as in many post-colonial states. And the Dutch kept hold of West Papua for various reasons. You could argue they kept on to it because they wanted to keep a bit of empire. They kept on to it because they wanted somewhere to go for Dutch who wanted to stay out in that part of the world. Also for some of the Indonesians who'd fought for the Dutch, didn't want to be part of independent Indonesia. Those were some of the reasons. But they also argued, and I think it was true, they argued that the Papuans were very different from the Indonesians. They had a different history, a different culture, different ethnic makeup. I mean, just to give you some context, in the Dutch East Indies, West Papua during that period, or West New Guinea, was not an important part of the Dutch East Indies. And in the early part of the 20th century, for example, there had been a call in the Dutch Parliament for West Papua to actually be administered as a separate colony. The argument was it's completely different to Asia, it should be treated differently and just administered as a different colony. But at the time, they argued that there were so few people, so few administrators in West Papua, it just wasn't worth it, and it made more sense just to govern it, continue governing it from the Dutch East Indies. And that's what happened. So when it came to Indonesian independence, it was a very bitter break. There'd been this war, the Dutch were very betrayed by Sukarno. They saw him as a traitor. He'd collaborated with Japanese in the war. Of course, the Indonesians would say, well, he was hardly a traitor, you know, to the Dutch. But nonetheless, there was a great deal of antipathy. There'd been a bitter fought dispute. And so it was a sticking point. In the negotiations before independence, they couldn't agree what to do with West Papua. Initially, some Indonesian leaders, such as Hatta, who was one of the chief leaders with Sukarno, he actually said, give the Papuans their independence. You know, they should have a right to freedom like anyone else. But by the time of the final negotiations, most of the Indonesian side had made a claim. They wanted the whole of the Dutch East Indies should be part of the new Indonesia, and that included West Papua, and that was their line. And as I said, the Dutch basically said, no, we're not going to do that. It'll be resolved within a year. They said, we'll come back in a year and try and resolve what to do about this particular dispute. And they set up a federal state, the independent Indonesia. But by about a year later, any idea of a federal state had gone. It was now a unitary state of Indonesia. And so the Dutch were even less inclined to deal with Indonesia. And the Papuans, it's worth noting, had very little say in the whole matter anyway. There'd hardly been any Papuan involvement in the Indonesian fight for independence. I would argue none, effectively. I think for most West Papuans, certainly in the territories and outside of the coastal areas, they probably had very little dealings with the Dutch anyway, let alone with the Indonesians. And those Papuans who had dealt with the Indonesians, the Dutch, were on the colony, were on the coastal areas. And they felt very out of it. There wasn't part of some great nationalist Indonesian movement in Papua at all. There was just no feeling of being part of Indonesia. And so for those reasons, independence was given to Indonesia. Indonesia and the Dutch in the 50s then fell out very badly. And the issue of West Papua, it became a non-self-governing territory under the Dutch rule. And the Dutch would every year, as part of the expectations of a non-self-governing territory, the Dutch would pass a report about progress, what they'd done to the territory, and that would go up to the UN. The Indonesians would then, several times throughout the 50s, negotiate, try and have dealings with the Dutch, but this didn't get anywhere. They brought the issue to the UN to try and get votes in favour of their position, that it should be part of Indonesia, but they didn't get anywhere of that at all. And so it continued throughout the 50s. By the time of the late 50s, Sukarno really built up the pressure. He gave up on any idea of peaceably getting West Papua. And he made very sort of threatening statements. He threatened war. He ceased all relations with the Dutch. He threw the Dutch out, threw out Dutch businesses in the late 50s. And he began a massive arms build-up, mainly via the Soviets, but with other countries as well. And so the idea was being there was this threat of war was increasing throughout the late 50s into the early 60s. Indonesia spoke of there's you know, if we don't get this resolved the way we want, basically there's going to be a war. If you look at the situation at the time, you look at America, and America began to get interested under Kennedy before they'd seen it as a minor issue. But Kennedy came into power, and he saw it very much as this rather small side issue, a small colonial issue. There are the Dutch down there. Why they're staying there, it's up to them. I think he described the territory as a couple of hundred square kilometres of cannibal land. It wasn't an important issue, but Indonesia was important. Indonesia, as you know, down the 60s, it was not a communist country, but the Communist Party of Indonesia was the largest party, I think, outside the communist bloc. So the way Kennedy saw it was, this issue has to be resolved, and it has to be resolved in favour of Indonesia, because if not, we're risking Indonesia becoming a communist country. If you look at, obviously, you have Indochina, you have all this sort of situation in the early 60s. The last thing the Americans wanted was some instability in Indonesia. And Sukarno, very, very cleverly, you could say, created this crisis. He more or less said, look, I've got to, if you give me West Papua, everything's going to be fine. I'll be your strong friend, your ally. If you don't, who knows what will happen? You know, we could become unstable, the communists could take over. It was quite a good game that Sukarno played. And in the end, the message got across. And to put it bluntly, the Americans finally became involved. They put a lot of pressure on the Dutch. And the Dutch were made aware that if there was a war with Indonesia over West Papua, they would have no support, no military support from the Americans, or for that matter, the Australians or the British. Now, up until about 1960, the Australians had been keen supporters that the Dutch stay on. Obviously, you have New Guinea. The western half is West Papua. The eastern half is now the independent state of Papua New Guinea. But then it was Australian-administered New Guinea. And the Australians certainly didn't want the Indonesians, this Asian power, this possibly communist Asian power, might suddenly appear on their border. So they were very keen to have the Dutch to stay. But by the early 60s, the Australians reckoned the game was up. The best bet was America's not going to give military support to the Dutch, the British aren't. They turned very quickly, and the Dutch realised they were isolated. There was going to be nobody to fight with them. And for that reason, they agreed to something called the New York Agreement, which was based on something called the Bunker Plan, which was an American-inspired negotiation process. And the New York Agreement was a UN-brokered agreement signed in August of 1962. And this agreement said that the Papuans should have a right to self-determination. The UN, but the Dutch would have to leave. The UN would take over the territory, and this was the first time the UN had actually taken over territory, and they would run this territory. Then after, at some stage, they would withdraw. Then the Indonesians would be allowed to administer the territory, and then at a point after that, it was about 6 years, the West Papuans would have a right to self-determination. The Dutch withdrew, finally, in October of 1962. The UN took over. And they were meant to be there to prepare the population for their right to self-determination. But the Indonesian soldiers had been parachuted in the months and years before in small numbers. They'd normally been rounded up and captured. They had no military effect. But they were there on the ground once the agreement was signed. And they were allowed to stay and become part of the UN force, which was mainly made up of Pakistani troops. But in effect, though the UN was meant to be in control, Indonesia was very much an influence, and the UN could do little without the Indonesian troops on the ground. And because of that, the UN allowed all sorts of freedoms to be curtailed for the Papuans. Under the New York Agreement, the Papuans were meant to have right to freedom of speech, political assembly, all these sorts of fundamental rights. But in effect, this didn't happen. For instance, there was a nationalist march in December 1962, when the UN were actually in charge, and it was banned. At the time, the UN said, oh, well, we agreed with the Papuan nationalists themselves not to have this march because it might cause some sort of disruption. But actually, if you look at the records, the UN banned it, and they banned it because they were given a threat by the Indonesians that if this march is allowed to go ahead, Indonesian troops on the ground may well cause trouble, may well cause violence. So the UN then left in May of 1963, which was the earliest they could have left. They could have actually stayed on longer, but they got out as soon as they could. And you have some UN officials on the ground at the time. You read their reports and they say, you know, we know there's going to be violence. We know the Papuans don't want to be ruled by the Indonesian, but we basically should just get out as soon as we can, just get out of this mess. So the UN left in 1963. However, under the New York Agreement, some of them should have stayed on. There should have been a UN presence throughout the 60s to be on the ground to supposedly help the Indonesians to prepare the Papuans for this act of self-determination. But the Indonesians said no, the UN made no protest, and so there was nobody there. And West Papua became very much a closed country from May of 1963. Very few people were allowed in, certainly little or no journalists, even diplomats. It took American diplomats a couple of years to get permission to actually even go in and visit. So it became a closed society, and during that period, the Indonesians unsurprisingly clamped down. It was the beginnings of the OPM, the Papuan Resistance Movement. There was fighting. The Indonesians bombed places like Manokwari. They killed, we'll never know how many people they killed, but they certainly killed, I think, thousands of people. And nobody else was out there. There was no presence on the ground to see what was going on. And under Sukarno, this was the leader who'd been there from the 50s onwards, he then announced, well, there'll be no act of free choice because the Papuans don't want it. They say there's no need, we want to be part of Indonesia. And he would always roll out a few Papuans who would say something like, we love Indonesia, that sort of thing. And this has been a common Indonesian tactic throughout the whole period. But when Sukarno was overthrown in the mid-60s, which I don't need to go into now, but when Sukarno was overthrown, Suharto took over, and he was pro-Western. And that gave the West probably even less reason to do anything about the West Papuan situation. Suharto took over. He then said, well, we will have an act of self-determination. And this was agreed to take place in 1969. But the argument was, the Papuans are too primitive to vote, they're just not developed enough, so we will decide our own way of having an act of self-determination. The UN, as part of this New York agreement, had a presence on the ground throughout this act of free choice and for a year beforehand, but it should have been 50 or 60 people, in the end it was about 17 or 18. And these UN staff on the ground, under a character called a Bolivian diplomat called Ortiz Sanz, they were there. He made suggestions, or he said, in my view, you should have a mixed method. He said to the Indonesians, I agree you can't have a vote for the whole country, but you can have a mixed method. So in the towns, you'll have direct voting. In the rural areas, you'll have some sort of representative voting, and they'll elect representatives to speak on your behalf. But the Indonesian line was, no, we're not going to have that. We're going to have it purely by just representatives. There'll be no direct voting. And they held throughout early 1969 a series of assemblies or get-togethers where these representatives who were going to speak on behalf of the Papuan people were supposedly elected. Again, very few journalists were allowed in, but a few of the journalists did get in. There's one Australian called Hugh Lunn who witnessed one of these supposed gatherings where they selected people. And he said he saw a load of Papuans gathered together, Indonesian soldiers, Indonesian plainclothes officers, saying, you're going to be the representatives, that's it. There was no vote, he said. He said he saw three Papuans come to the front, sit down with a placard saying, we want a vote, we want one man, one vote. And he said, although Ortiz Sanz, the head of the UN mission, was there, he did nothing when these three were dragged off and arrested. So, this was when Ortiz Sanz was actually there. The UN actually saw very few of these assemblies. You can imagine what actually happened for the rest of them. And in effect, what happened in 69, just over 1,000 Papuans were gathered together in about 8 different assemblies throughout the country for a final vote in front of Indonesian generals, a few foreign diplomats. And they voted 100% in a public show of hands to stay with Indonesia. And the Indonesians said, well, this was a fair representation of the population, which was over 1 million people. The UN took note of this, the UN General Assembly, a few months later. And apart from some protests from some African countries, that was pretty much it. The UN, the international community, washed their hands of the situation. In the years since, it's been hard to estimate how many people have died. People talk up to 100,000 since the Indonesian took over. It is hard to judge, but certainly many people have been killed. Under Suharto, who was basically a dictator who ruled with military power, there was a massive transmigration from other parts of Indonesia. That's probably one of the key issues. As soon as the Indonesians came in, they started this process, but it really took off probably after the Act of Free Choice, when people from other parts of Indonesia poured in. And today, it's hard to estimate, but you could say up to half the population is now not West Papuan. So you have a situation where the West Papuans are looking at being a minority in their own country. Many tens of thousands have been killed. They have very little say in the running of their government. The Indonesians would appoint, traditionally, a Papuan governor, but he would have no power whatsoever. He would be almost a figurehead. This was certainly the situation throughout the 70s and 80s and beyond there. The Papuans were sidelined, to put it crudely. But it was a colony. It was an old-fashioned colonial situation. Indonesians who would do a tour of duty, the army or whatever, civil servants, would go into West Papua initially. It would be for a few years at a time, and they would treat it very much as a colonial expedition. They would go there, they would try and get what they can out of it, and then they would leave. The Papuans, as I say, would be sidelined. Any efforts, the Dutch in their last few years had actually made a concerted effort to get they call it Papuanization of the administration. It was a sort of normal thing you do when you leave a colony. You try and train up an elite, if you like. That's what happened in lots of other colonies. The Dutch did the same. But once the Indonesians came in, that was pretty much scrapped. Papuans, even those Papuans, those few Papuans who'd had sympathy for the Indonesians when they arrived, a lot of those then turned against it. Some actually then who'd been diplomats or even soldiers in the new Indonesian regime, within a few years had actually gone over and joined what was called the Free Papua Movement, the OPM. You couldn't say the OPM was ever going to be a threat in the effect that they would be able to drive Indonesia out militarily. Small, disparate group is my understanding. But nonetheless, the OPM, which had its roots in about 1965, became a symbol of Papuan resistance throughout all those decades. The OPM would carry out small attacks on troops, or they would sabotage a pipeline at Freeport. This was something happening late 78, 79. And then in 84, there was an uprising in 1984. It wasn't particularly successful, but because of it, tens of thousands of Papuans fled over the border into what was then independent and still is independent Papua New Guinea. In this situation, there have been refugees, there has been military clampdowns. The Indonesian military, I think about 70% of Indonesian military wealth, they have to create themselves. They get 30% from the government, they have to make 70% themselves. And West Papua is a very rich place. We talked about Freeport, there's logging, there's all sorts of things going on. So for the Indonesian army, they almost like to justify their presence there. They can say, oh, look at the OPM, we've got to protect Freeport mine. And they run it because almost like a protection racket. And that, so it suited the Indonesians very well, the Indonesian army very well, to have West Papua to clamp down, to kill people when they want, to get money from incoming firms, that sort of thing. And it's been run as a very good, it's a source of immense wealth for Indonesia, and the Papuan people have had seen little or none of it. In recent years, we've had special autonomy imposed upon West Papua. Again, this was something that supposedly was going to involve the West Papuans. They could decide, well, how do you want to have your special autonomy, a more devolved form of government, so you have a greater say in things. But in effect, there was talk of autonomy, and then there was an announcement they're going to divide West Papua into two and then three different provinces. And this was done without any consultation with the Papuans. And as we stand now, I suppose it's a case of divide and rule. For some West Papuan elite, it makes sense to have their own province. If you say West Indian Jaya is the new, or West Papua has actually been called, is a new province, that suits some of, you could say, some of the elite, because it gives them access to power and access to the money that will come from special autonomy. But for the Papuan people as a whole, I would argue, from my understanding, it's just seen as a continuation of Indonesian rule. The Dutch, in 1999, the Dutch Foreign Affairs Department did commission a report by Professor Drugliever to look into the Act of Free Choice. And actually at the time, this was really quite a great surprise. The Dutch had done nothing really to try and muddy the waters or cause any problems with the Indonesians over West Papua. But nonetheless, they did commission this report. And this report was meant to take a couple of years, and in the end it took nearly 6 years. And before it came out, there was a lot of idea to say, well, this will have no effect. This is not a government report to commission policy. It's purely a historical document. So a lot was done beforehand. There was a change of administration. A lot was done beforehand to try and belittle this report, you could say. But nonetheless, it was a government-commissioned report, and that is something that has to be remembered. And when this report came out in November of 2005, it's a very long book. It's in Dutch. It hasn't been translated to English yet, but a summary is available in English. And I mean, I personally, as someone who's worked on the subject, was really very relieved to see that it said what I suppose any true report could say. It said that the Act of Free Choice had been flawed, that Papuans had been killed, they had not been given their free right to self-determination, and they've suffered ever since. And so this report, despite the government trying to push it to the side, the Dutch government, the fact was they commissioned this report. It's an official report. And it says what everybody knew, that that the West Papuans had not been given the right to self-determination, that they'd been treated very badly, tens of thousands had been killed. And there was a launch of it in November 2005, there was some coverage. But since then, the Indonesians and the Dutch together government have tried to sort of push it to the side. In 2000, there was a congress, a massive meeting. It was probably the largest gathering of Papuans to call for what they wanted. And what they wanted, they called for a referendum. They wanted what happened in 1969 to be examined, to see what actually happened, you know, what really was the case. They wanted to be overturned, effectively, and they wanted to have a fresh referendum. And at the time, it was Taya Selloway who was seen as the Papuan leader. And he was seen very much as a leader throughout many Papuan communities. He united, and he had his faults, but he was seen as a uniting force for Papuan nationalism. And he was by no means a violent person. The Papuan Presidium was seen as a peaceful organisation. But nonetheless, within a year or so, he'd actually been murdered by the Indonesian military. I mean, he'd gone off to a military base, he'd been invited as a guest, and on the way back he was actually garrotted by some Indonesian Special Forces troops. In the end, a few junior soldiers were sent to prison for maybe 3 or 4 years for this, and one of the Indonesian generals said, well, these men are heroes because they're defending the Indonesian state. This was said only a few years ago. So the situation, people might talk of how it's changed now, but even today, if a West Papuan tries to peaceably raise a Papuan flag, Bintang Kejora, which is the Morning Star flag, they can be sent to prison for 15 years. I mean, they're not allowed to have a nationalist party. There might be moved toward this, but as it stands at the moment, there's no Papuan peaceful nationalist party allowed to vote to say, well, we'd like to have a choice on freedom or whatever. So there's a long way to go before the Papuans even get to a stage where they could peaceably and legally call for what they want, whether they want independence or whether they want autonomy or whatever.